And welcome to Resistance Radio. I am John Kane. I am your host, and I want to thank you for joining me. And we are broadcasting this week only in Washington, D.C., and of course on Facebook live stream, and the show will be posted up as a podcast. So missing out in New York, unless you're catching us on Facebook or, I don't know, streaming us on the WPFW's website, you can that streams the show live as well. So I got a couple of big topics I want to talk about, and then I got a bit of a remembrance I want to do. You know, as you get older, and when you have older friends, you realize that you're going to lose some along the way. And I have had I've had the great pleasure to get to know a woman who is who led a quite remarkable life, and I'm speaking of Julie Belafonte, Julie Robinson Belafonte. She was the wife of Harry Belafonte for over 50 years. That in of itself, when you consider a mixed race relationship in that era, was a challenge to her life all by herself. But she took on lots of challenges. She was very active. She was a political activist on many levels, worked closely with a lot of Native activists over the years. I've got friends who worked high steel in New York City for, you know, for generations, my father among them. And I know Julie interacted with some of the roughnecks that climbed high steel. But she was also, like I said, she was very politically active. She knew Fidel Castro personally. Her parents were actually friends with him, as she was. And she was a real big part of what I would consider many social movements, including AIM. I don't know to the extent that she was involved with Black Panthers, but she certainly was involved in the civil rights movement. In fact, what Julie was primarily, she was a dancer, and she was the only white member of a pretty much an all black dance ensemble, and they actually produced a I don't know if it would be an opera, operetta, or what you actually call it, but it was called Southland. And Julie, because she was the white girl in the crew, played the white girl in the play. And the play is based on a white woman making a false accusation against a black man doing something inappropriate to her. And of course, in real life, this played out many times over in many communities where white folks were looking for a reason to, you know, to just wreak havoc on Native people, including, or on black people, including in places like Black Wall Street in Tulsa. So this play was controversial, and it came in the heat of that controversy. In fact, it was banned in some places. I think it was performed in other countries in Europe. And I think it was brought back to life fairly recently. Obviously, Julie's time as a dancer had passed, but I know she followed it very closely. So her life was incredible. Now I got the opportunity to meet her because her daughter Gina wanted to do a radio broadcast, and she called a conversation with Julie Belafonte basically, and so Gina invited me to be a part of that conversation. And so we did a great show on WBAI in New York City. And that's when I got to meet and know and become friends with Julie Belafonte. And Julie's been friends with my wife and I for many years as a result of that. Julie used to come to all my live events in New York, whether it was down at the Brooklyn Commons when I would do film screenings and the like, or bring in guests. She made the trip out to Huntington on Long Island to see the film screenings that I did at the Cinema Arts Center with Cindy Campbell, Clive Campbell's sister. And so she was, you know, really got involved in a lot of what I was doing. She even made the trip up here to Seneca territory, stayed at the Seneca Niagara Casino Hotel. There was an event that she participated with me at. And of course she came up to visit. So, very good friends. I've stayed at her place. I've been to a dinner party or two at her house, or at her apartment in New York. Several years ago, Gina, and very conscious of Julie's advanced age, moved her out to California where Gina was living. And I haven't had a chance to see her since she went to the West Coast. I tried to catch up with her one time, right around when Harry had passed, which was less than a year ago. Things didn't quite work out. So I was very saddened to see Gina's announcement that her mother had passed away. And, you know, I wanted to give a certain tribute to my friend, who reached the ripe age of 95 years old, outlived Harry Belafonte, Sidney Poitier, Marlon Brando, and all these people that she was, you know, so closely involved with over the years in the entertainment industry. I just want to acknowledge her life. I want to thank her for her friendship. I want to thank Gina for introducing me to her mother. And for those of you who don't know her story, I encourage you to look her up. You'll see some of the some of the work that she was involved with. I mean, the thing about doing a radio program with her, we got to go through so much of the incredible conversations that she had. She was there when Martin Luther King was assassinated. She was there. So many critical parts of American history, especially involving, you know, social injustice. She was there with Harry and there on her own right as well. So again, I want to thank you for having influenced me and for having come into my life. So rest in peace, Julie Belafonte. Okay, a couple of things. Killers of the Flower Moon went 0 for 10 at the Oscars. Now, I've weighed in a bit on the film. I had David Grand, the author of the book, on my program when the book first came out, and had great conversations with him. I was a little wary of the film because of the star power that was being introduced, especially playing the white characters. I mean, you had Martin Scorsese as the director, you had Leonardo DiCaprio, Robert De Niro, and those actors playing those parts wasn't my biggest concern. My biggest concern was how the film was going to take real life characters from that are represented in a book and were representative in history, and transpose them into characters on a film. I mean, what kind of creative license was going to be taken? And there was much. I mean, I've heard some people say that the film followed the book closely. I didn't think so. I mean, one of the things that Scorsese did was really put the DiCaprio character, which was Ernest Burkhart, in scenarios and scenes, activities that he was that the book never suggested he was a part of, including robbing people, killing, one of the private investigators. There was nothing in the book that suggested that Ernest Burkhart had done those things. The thing is about Killers of the Flower Moon, you had a situation that was born out of, you know, legal opinions and legal doctrine that cast this wealthy group of Native people, the Osage, as incompetent people, people untrustworthy and incompetent to run their own affairs. So even though they had the wealth, oil wealth that was being generated from their lands, the federal government and others imposed this idea of registering each time they were to get a payment of some sort or even try to gain access to the money, they'd have to register as incompetents or have a white guardian or have achieved some level of, frankly, whitewashing of their lineage, I guess. In other words, being half white or whatever, to have any control over their own money. So they they were deemed incompetent, and white people had control over almost every aspect of their life. And I'm not talking about Congress. I mean the storekeeper. I mean the lawyer, the doctor, the dentist, all these people who were the prominent white people living on Osage territory were the ones who controlled the Osage wealth. And a bit of a scheme developed where some of these men who were unscrupulous in the first place would try to shack up with Native women and gain access, at least indirectly, to their money, but then took it a step farther. I said, well, geez, if I marry a Native woman, have a couple of kids, and she should happen to, die by whatever means, even though the children would have the head rights, I'd have control of it. And so this is the story behind the Killers of the Flower Moon. And it's a real story. And it was a broad-based, almost culture of corruption. It wasn't even just a conspiracy. Because it wasn't, unlike the film indicates, where it was perpetrated by, one bad guy and his henchmen, including one of his nephews, which was, and the bad guy in the film was Robert De Niro. He played William Hale. And his nephew was the DiCaprio character, Ernest Burkhardt. Yes, he did have a scheme on how the money could flow toward to his family by consolidating some of the head rights among in one particular family that his nephew had married into. But that wasn't the only thing that happened there. But see, that's the way the film got done. And so there was a lot of character development associated with the De Niro character and with the DiCaprio character. And it didn't necessarily ring true to the history. I mean, in general, it's a movie based on a true story. It's not the true story. The problem that I had with it is that it wasn't centered so much towards the Osage people. And the leading female character was Molly Burkhardt, the wife of Ernest Burkhardt, played by Lily Gladstone. And I felt like they didn't give this character or any of the women characters much depth. I mean, as a Native person, I know what it's like to live amongst Native women. And Native women are not the stoic, mild-mannered, a non-confrontational type of person. I know they aren't that way now, and I'm not just talking about Mohawk women. I mean Native women in general. And I don't suspect they were then. I believe that the Molly Burkhardt character could have been played with much more cunning. And I mean the Leonardo DiCaprio character played a bit of a dimwit. But that doesn't mean that she couldn't have been manipulative and thought, well, I could use this guy to have access to my own money. And even in the film where they suggest that Molly had hired a private investigator, they didn't have her acting out doing any of that. So her on-screen presence didn't show her thought process, didn't show her desire to seek the truth. It just made her a victim. And while I think Lily Gladstone played the part remarkably, and especially considering the way the character was developed by Scorsese and company, and she was up for the female actress or actor award and lost. I mean, she won Golden Globes and People's Choice, a couple of other award season trophies along the way. But this was the kind of a big deal. And Killers of the Flower Moon was up for 10 nominations and struck out, didn't win a one. Now, look, they put some, they had some Native performers on stage, which was kind of a cool thing. Lily Gladstone got lots of attention there, and which is a good thing. But then there was a lot of crying foul afterwards. Well, did the Native people get snubbed? Well, all I've got to say is that we didn't produce the film. A white man produced the film. A white man wrote the book that the film was based on. Although I had no grievances with the book, I did have some with the film. Now, do I think it warranted a nomination? Yeah, I think it probably did. But what were the problems with the film? Well, for one thing, it cost a lot of money considering what it was. It was a long film. It was like three and a half hours long. But again, it kind of jumped around. It didn't show the depth of the what the real racist situation was in terms of how these rich Native people were being treated so badly. And it also, it kept, you know, putting the number of dead at around 20 or 30. By some estimations, including by the calculated by folks like David Grand, the author of the book, he suggests that it was in the hundreds and may have approached 1,000 people. The records of the Osage show a ton of deaths that were never properly attributed to anything other than just died. You know, and many of them were clearly murders when somebody was shot or poisoned or blown up in a house. But I'll admit, and I watched this film three times, and watching it three times isn't easy because it's a long film to go through. But I wish that people would see the film so they understand at least the theme of what was going on then. But my caution to anybody is, the film is not true history. It is a representation. It's a film based on a true story. It is not the true story. I was disappointed that Lily Gladstone didn't win the Oscar. And there are a lot of mixed feelings that people have had. Most of them were outright condemnation on the Academy. And I don't know what the criterion was. And I don't know if those who viewed the film saw the same things that I saw. I mean, as a Native person, I know I was looking for certain things. I don't know if members of the Film Academy were going to see the same shortcomings of the film that I saw. But Martin Scorsese doesn't usually strike out with a film. So, you know, again, I want people to see the film. And even in spite of my criticisms of the film, I think this might be the closest thing to understanding what the Osage went through and what we still go through. This is going to be the closest thing that white people will ever come to know. So I know that you're not going to, especially, you know, if you're out of high school, you're not going to learn anything. If you're in high school currently, you're not going to learn anything. My hope is in the future, there will be some more of this taught. There would be a better understanding. There would be more information about what Native people went through, not just the Osage, but people all over the continent, including residential schools, including missing and murdered Indigenous women. This essentially is a missing and murdered Indigenous women's film, but it's not cast that way. And there's nothing that ever contemporizes the problem in, you know, coming out of the film. I think they did some things that were okay and some things that were kind of neat. Again, I will say that I was a little disappointed in the film. I'm not going to say I was completely disappointed. The reason I was disappointed is because I wanted it to be better. I wanted it to be more accurate. And I wanted somebody to be able to see this film and not feel sympathy for the villains. I mean, and understand that even as victims, we weren't victims because we were dim-witted, because we were incompetent or somehow mentally challenged in any other way. We were victims because of policy and a policy that allowed this to even happen. Look, these guys had to elicit an investigation. The FBI was a brand new institution, and there was no rush to get, from the federal government to investigate this thing. And all the local stuff, they were just washing it over. These guys from Osage, they even reached out to Charles Curtis, who I think was a senator at the time. He would go on to be the vice president of the United States. But Charles Curtis, who was the only Native person, a Native person who reached the vice presidency, wouldn't give these guys the time of day. He was a senator out of Kansas, I believe. Kansas or Nebraska, one of them anyway. He was a congressman, then a senator, and ultimately the vice president of the United States. And these guys thought, okay, a Native person in a high-ranking position, we've heard this all the time. We go through this today. Oh, we got Deb Haaland in the Interior Department. Surely we're going to see some justice now. Not so much. So, I mean, I think this is a valuable story. And even if it's told a little haphazardly, at least it's being told. So I'll give it that. But, you know, my hope is that somebody sees the movie and maybe they read the book. Or maybe I know there's a documentary that's coming out. And I think, Long Knives, I think, is what it's called. And so I look forward to that. So I hope people will take the time to understand not just this tragedy, but tragedies that have come since then. One of the things that this film, and frankly the book didn't either, was really talk about how much the Osage had gotten screwed by the oil companies in the first place. I mean, you could clearly see how white people converged on Osage territory to make money as oil riggers and all that other stuff. I mean, there was a lot of money that was flowing through these native communities. And look, these people were buying cars. They were, you know, they were living fairly lavish lives. White people went there to be servants to the Osage, maids chauffeurs and the like, because it was easy money and the Osage paid well. So they could, you know, there were people that just rained down on Osage territory to line their pockets. And many of these people who were hired by Osage weren't really working. They loved being lazy. They loved going there and just living off the Osage money. And that's what they did. That was the mild form of taking advantage of the Osage. It got much worse to where it was murder, and the kind of premeditated murder that, frankly, is unfathomable. I mean, just imagine having a mindset that says, if I seduce a woman, have children with the woman, and then kill the woman's sisters, so all the head rights come to her, and then ultimately kill her, I can gain control of the head rights because I'll be the guardians of the children. And who knows, maybe even a child or two will go along the way. And there were children who died needlessly out there. So I mean, just imagining the level of premeditation that took place in a broad-based way, not just, you know, William Hale and Ernest Burkhart, the DiCaprio and De Niro characters. No, it was a wholesale pillaging of Osage wealth. And I dare say we're going through it still today. We're still going through much of that kind of thing. And we see it in the gaming industry. We see it in the way companies prey upon native territories to whether it's the extraction industries, that leave contamination and unsafe conditions, open pit uranium mining comes to mind. But the usage, the use of water. I mean, we see a situation today where the Navajo are being limited water because there's, four or five states that are trying to gobble up all the water from the Colorado River, leaving the end of that river going into Navajo territory, leaving them, and it's something like, gallons of water per day is all they're afforded. While golf courses are being watered down. And while, all of this industry is being supported in the state. And there is, in the law, a protection of water rights for the Navajo. But again, as I've said multiple times on this program, those laws, even when they sound nice, they don't protect us. The laws are not produced to protect us. The Constitution wasn't written to protect us. We weren't a part of it. So when we look at these situations, when we see these injustices, we know that the laws are part of the injustice. They are not set up to combat injustices. And the Navajo are seeing this with water today. So, look, I am disappointed that Killers of the Flower Moon didn't win any of the awards at the Oscars. I didn't stay up and watch it. I already had my reservations about what the Oscars were going to be like. And so I just kind of looked at the score sheet as it was coming along. I saw Oppenheimer, and I thought Oppenheimer was a decent film. And I think it was done better than Killers of the Flower Moon. It wasn't a better story. I don't think there's a more compelling story in American history than the Osage murders. It just wasn't told that well, unfortunately. And I apparently I'm not the only one who saw it that way, because even Lily Gladstone, with her phenomenal performance in a very limited role, as far as I was concerned, got a lot of praise during the award season, but fell short in the at the Academy Awards. So disappointed for her. I know I expect great things to come for her and others. I'm hoping that she has left the door open for others, and that's what she's talked about. And look, she stepped up on everything from the mascot issue. She's used her the attention that she's garnered to speak out on a lot of issues. But here's what I will say. One of the problems with being starstruck, so you have somebody with the credentials of Martin Scorsese coming to your territory and bringing lots of money with him, by the way. I mean, because, I'm sure a lot of money got dumped into those communities. A lot of Osage, played parts in the film and that kind of stuff. But you can become enamored with the star power, the Scorsese, De Niro, DiCaprio. You can see these and just be so thrilled that you've got this kind of star power telling your story that you don't necessarily speak out, And Lily Gladstone, as an up and comer, I mean, look, she's done some films and she's done some great performances, as far as I'm concerned. But she wasn't a household name. She wasn't going to stand up to. I mean, DiCaprio literally helped dictate how the story was going to be told. Lily Gladstone didn't have that kind of power. Maybe she'll have some now, so for the next time. But we become starstruck, and especially when these people come into our communities, and look, their intentions for the most part are good. I mean, they do want to tell a compelling story, but they have it in their mind how a compelling story has to be told, and the decision was made early on in the film that they weren't going to make the FBI agent the hero. Instead, they were going to key on essentially the villains. DiCaprio was going to play the FBI agent. And he said, no, he decided that he could get more depth of character out of playing the one who was claimed to be in love with with his wife while he was killing off her family members. And that's what we as an audience were led to believe. We were expected to believe that he could be cold and cowardice and ruthless while killing all of his wife's family members and still claim to be in love with his wife. And I don't buy it. I don't buy it even with Leonardo DiCaprio playing the role. But this is the tough part. I know that we aren't at a place right now where we have agency to tell completely our own stories. And one of the things is this film was expensive. I'm hoping it doesn't scare away the next studio to say, no, we're not going to spend that kind of money on another Native film. This one didn't do as well in the box office as we had hoped. Well, I don't think it was the story. I think it was the telling. And I'm not, criticizing Scorsese in general as a director and a producer. I know he's done some good work, and I've liked many of his films. This one I was disappointed in. So anyway, that's my wrap up on the award season. I do look forward to seeing Lily Gladstone and so many of the others that were in the film, Native actors and actresses. I mean, Russell Means' son, I thought, represented himself very well. Look, many of the Native actors did. But and I'm hoping that this leads them to a place where they can, tell Native stories more accurately. All right, so that's Killers of the Flower Moon and their strikeout at the Oscars. Another thing is going on this week, or in fact, it's just wrapping up. It's called Res 2024, and what Res stands for is Reservation Economic Summit, and these have been going on for several decades. This one, and the theme for this year's Res 2024 was strength and unity. I was glad to see that, because the way, and I've tracked these over the years, and for the most part, when I first became aware of these Reservation Economic Summits, they were basically governments with their set-asides, setting up in this large convention and their contractors to bring Native people in to have the opportunity to contract with the federal government or the defense contractors or government or other government contractors And it was supposed to be this opportunity for Native territories to utilize perhaps government programs like set-asides and certain, you know, no-bid kinds of contracts to have an advantage in those contracts and develop economically. The problem was it was primarily government and government contractors that were raining down on these, on these Native peoples to either set up manufacturing, you know, or whatever. But there was also extractive industries and, you know, all these things that, you know, frankly, have taken advantage of Native peoples. Now, I'm not necessarily criticizing those government agencies and their contractors for offering, you know, Native work. But when you consider that a lot of it was based on military, you know, and we've got to, at some point, we have to make some decisions on what we want to support, even with our economic development. And I'll get into another circumstance that is tackling the same issue in just a few minutes. But the trend changed, and eventually it started to be less about non-Native corporations coming in at these economic summits with their offerings to Native people, and it started to turn a little bit more towards what we were going to do with and for each other. And so this strength and unity theme for this year's conference, I found encouraging. As I have said over the last few weeks, I have been trying to pound on certain legal doctrines that have been used to prevent Native-to-Native trade. Native-to-Native trade is key to our survival. It's one of the many things that the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples is supposed to protect, and protect it as a part of what that document says is the minimum standard for our survival and dignity. Look, our territories are vast. I don't mean in terms of size, but in location. We are in many places across the continent, some very, very rural and remote, some with cities in our backyard. I'm talking to you from the Cattaraugus Territory of the Seneca Nation. I got Buffalo 30 miles away. Many Native territories have urban areas not far from them. And so access to a market seems pretty viable. Others are more remote, where there may not be a good flow of consumers. So by putting our heads together, we can figure out, okay, well, your territory may not have a large consumer base, but you have these kind of resources, or you have perhaps cheap power, or you have some other attributes that we don't have here. But the key is, if we all do some things together, we can all benefit from whatever, assets we have, whatever incentives we have. Some territories have fought harder against the state taxation and even against federal taxation. So perhaps certain things happen in those territories and are distributed Native to Native to other territories. This is what we've been promoting. And this is where I hoped this conference would lean to. And it did a little bit. There was still an awful lot of, people talking about, talking about what we can do for the country, and meaning the United States, and having real difficulty in drawing a line between our territories and the United States. I think there are a lot of people who still suffer with major identity problems about who they are. Are they Americans? Are they Native? Are they both? And we hear things like dual citizenship thrown around, like that's really a thing. And of course, we get into these election season, and people want to use us as poster children for their causes. You know, especially the Democrats want to promote themselves as being the party that supports Native rights, even though I would argue we experience just as much racism from the left as we do from the right. So we get sucked into their politics, and then people want to do these get out the vote campaigns, and that was even mentioned at this conference. I would love to see a day where none of that, I'm not saying the contractors, but look, I don't want FBI recruitment being a part of some sort of economic development opportunity, or state police, or any, certainly recruitment into the military. I don't want recruitment as a part of a conference comes into our territory to military service or government work, that kind of government work. I really don't. And I'd love to see a day that it's no longer tolerated by many of our territory. I mean, look, I know that they've tried to do recruitment here in Seneca territory, and it gets a mixed bag of reaction here. We still have people who, when they do their powwow here in Seneca territory, it's the veterans' powwow. So they still are elevating this idea of military service in a way that I still don't feel quite comfortable with. But here, you know, here's the other thing. We still have a major language problem. And I'm not just talking about the loss of our language. I'm talking about the language that we are prepared to continue to use. Words like tribe and tribal, American Indian, Native American, reservations. I mean, there's a lot of, look, there's the American Indian movement. Look, the problem I have with AIM is those first two words don't even talk to me. I'm not a part of an American Indian movement. I'm not even part of a movement. I'm Native, and I'm fighting for my rights. I'm not trying to start some sort of political movement within the social fabric of the United States. And I'm not saying that's entirely what AIM was all about. But when you have American Indian in your name, I've already got a problem with that. And same with NCAI, National Congress of the American Indian. At some point, we've got to be more conscious of the language and the words we're using. The problem I have with tribe and tribal and tribalism is we know that that's a derogatory word. How? Just listen to the news. Anytime they talk about the tribal regions of Africa or the tribal regions of Afghanistan, they aren't talking about sophisticated people. They're talking about backwards people. Or when they're calling down the behavior of politicians, they say, well, everybody went tribal. They don't mean they rose up and they became more sophisticated. So anytime that word is used in the English vernacular, it's an insult. It's pejorative. And when we use it for ourselves, what are we saying about ourselves? I mean, this gets back to the same thing where I complain about us using this notion of a federal trust responsibility. I mean, that's like saying that we are the incompetence that from the Killers of the Flower Moon. We are too incompetent to run our own gaming industries. Why? Because the federal government is our trustee. We are the wards of the state. There's language that we have to get away from. And including in these kinds of conferences, I would love to, I mean, I think, I don't even remember the name of the organization that puts it on. But again, it's got the word Indian in their name. I think that we don't have to call it Reservation Economic Summit. It could be Native Economic Summit. We are Native people. We're Native peoples. And that's the best English words I can use. We have our own words. Ongwe, Gunyagaaga, Rudinishuni. We have our own kinds of words that describe a little bit who we are and contextualizes who we are. But what context are we bringing to ourselves if we call ourselves American Indians or Native Americans? And I got to tell you, I hate being referred to as the first Americans because we predate the concept. I think language matters. And look, in a perfect world, we'd be speaking our language all the time, but we would still be faced, even if we spoke our own language, with how we translate it and the English words we use to describe what we're talking about. So English language matters too, and it matters to us. So if we're going to use these non-native words and these non-native constructs and concepts, because look, there's something that comes with it. When we use words like nation and nationhood, which may not be the best box to put us in, there it automatically has political connotation to it. When we use words like citizen, oh, I'm not a U.S. citizen, I'm a Mohawk citizen. No, I'm not a Mohawk citizen either. So these words have other connotations associated with them. So I think when we use them, look, the word sovereignty. The problem I have with the word sovereignty is that its origins are based on this notion that somehow God has bestowed power on the royal families of Europe. And that it's this manifestation of God's will and power and domain over other human beings. When we use the word sovereignty now, and when we use it especially, we're talking about just possessing the right for our own self-determination, our right to decide for ourselves. So that's what we're talking about. We're talking about the power and the right and the duty to carry ourselves, not necessarily to rule over others or rule over land, which is the way sovereignty has been used traditionally. So even that word, if we're going to use them, we've got to take a time out and say, look, before I go any farther talking about sovereignty, let me explain to you what I mean by it. So I've got to redefine it for you. And if I got to redefine it for you, maybe I shouldn't be using it in the first place. So I say these things because these are words do matter. And I think if we aren't careful, we put ourselves into these boxes. Look, we're not Indians. We never were Indians. It was a misnomer by a guy who we should have no affection or affinity towards whatsoever. Columbus is the one who coined the phrase by referring to us as Indians. And no, he didn't think he landed on the coast of India. He thought he had reached the Indian Islands, the Indies of Indonesia. He died believing he had reached the easternmost islands of Indonesia. He didn't know that he had met an entire hemisphere of land and peoples and continents that he was unaware of. He didn't even know it. He wasn't this brilliant and brave explorer. He was a guy trying to make a buck. And when he couldn't bring back the wealth and the spices that he'd hoped to bring back from Indonesia, he enslaved our people. He enslaved our people to dig for gold and for minerals. He enslaved our people and brought them back. The first transatlantic slave ships were Columbus's going back to Europe with native people on them. And not all those people made the trip. Many died along the way, which has always been the nature of this transatlantic slave routes. So I think it's important that we, even as we figure out these mechanisms in these conferences, look, I don't anticipate anytime soon that I'm going to headline any of these plenary sessions of these conferences. I know that some of what I have to say is still considered somewhat outlierish. It's not something that the broad-based Native community is prepared to hear. I mean, I condemn voting. I condemn voting in their elections. I condemn serving in their military. I condemn worshiping their God. These are not widely held sentiments across Native territories. I have reasons for having that position. I'm not beating anybody. When I say I condemn it, I mean I condemn it for myself. I understand people are going to do what they got to do. And I know why people enlist in the military. Part of it is we have so very little opportunities in some of the most impoverished territories of our peoples that serving the military, even in the most violent eras of American or of world history, seemed like a better option than starving to death on a native territory. It's the same thing that contributes to missing and murdered indigenous women, the conditions on our territory. So that's why I say, when I heard strength and unity as a theme for Res 2024, I mean, oh, that's not bad. That's going in the right direction. And that's what I hope we can build on. Maybe next year it's going to be more about unity. More, maybe native-to-native trade will be the theme all by itself. And maybe we start to consider how we collaborate. And look, I don't even think we do very good cross-promotion from one native gaming operation to another native gaming operation. I think that we could package these things up. We could do tours. We could do all kinds of stuff, even within the gaming industry. But there's a lot more that our territories have to offer. If you drew circles around every one of our territories, let's say go out 150 miles from our territory. So you had these 300 mile circles, diameter circles around each one of our territories. We have 90% of the population of U.S. and Canada within those circles that we have access. That's a drivable market to reach. So whether it's food production, whether it's manufacturing, whether it's entertainment, tourism, we have a lot to offer. And we can hit a huge cross-section of the U.S. and Canadian population with what we have to offer. But if we collaborate with each other, because look, we aren't going to get the same kind of bank financing. We aren't going to get tax-exempt bonds offered up by urban municipalities or whatever else to help fund this stuff. We've got to realize our own incentives. We have to realize how we utilize sovereignty and our autonomy as a regulatory advantage, as an asset. And these kinds of conferences are the places where we can put our heads together and say, oh, here's how we package it. Now, one of the big topics in this year's conference was the cannabis industry, which is part of what I was addressing with native-to-native trade. Look, states are having a real difficult time on how to deal with each other in the cannabis industry. Federal government's still sitting back saying, well, it's still an illegal substance, but we're just not going to do anything about it yet. But in the meantime, banks and insurances and all these other, you know, the idea of using electronic banking for placing your orders or even doing credit card processing, that's still hands off with a lot of the stuff. Everybody's too terrified to even try it. And banks are not just condemning us for the cannabis industry. It's gotten to the point where if you're a native person and you want to set up a merchant account, the second you mention you're native, we're not interested. I mean, they literally are pulling the racist card on every turn when it comes to some of these financial institutions and the financial products that they offer, because they're afraid we're doing something that's going to get them in trouble. Or at least that's the excuse. So, look, I was encouraged by this. But like I said, in the beginning, this was all about these contracts that are being offered by federal governments and stuff like that. And, you know, now that there's been a lot more pushback, and today we're seeing it in real time, the festival in Austin, Texas, South by Southwest, has been plagued with people saying, no, I'm not going to go to the performer. 30 bands, over 30 bands at last count, have canceled performing at South by Southwest. And part of their boycott and their protest is over the Israel-Gaza situation. But it's also because of the military presence and the defense contractors that are sponsors. They're saying, look, I don't think I want to be a part of this thing if it's got Raytheon and military contractors that are sponsoring these programs. And I say, great, it's about time. Because this is the issue. We don't have to vote in elections when we can vote with our dollars. How we spend our money, who we're going to perform for. I mean, one of my biggest grievances was when the Iroquois Nationals, the Haudenosaunee lacrosse team, went and played in a tournament in Israel in the midst of major conflict where Palestinians were being shot through the fence by Israeli soldiers. I'm thinking, why would we send our people there? Why would we support a country that is committing the same kinds of atrocities that our people experienced? And this is where we have to wake up. So let this Reservation Economic Summit take a turn towards solidarity amongst our people and taking a position that is more politically correct for us. I was glad to see the number of performers who are saying, no, I'm not going to be a part of South by Southwest, but you know what? I will perform at a protest concert, a concert in support of Gaza and the Palestinians. You know, I think that's a positive movement. I really do. And this is, as Native people, we still have we don't have much voting power, but we do have purchasing power. And you know what? Our allies do too. And if we can convince Black people and Hispanic people to collaborate with us on how and where we spend money, how and where we invest and build in, perhaps it isn't just Native to Native trade. Maybe it is Native to Black community trade, Native to Hispanic community trade. Because we are all under the gun here. So, and I think we do have to stand together. I realize that there's a lot of lines that separate people, and church has a big part to do with that. A lot of Black people are Christians. A lot of Hispanic people are Christians, Catholics in particular. And that line gets kind of tough sometimes, for especially for people, Native people who have been victimized by the churches so many. But I'm going to tell you, a lot of Native people are Christians too. So these are the challenges. And look, I was optimistic with the theme of this year's Res 2024 conference, and I'm hoping that theme will continue to move in the direction that has Native people working together. And if it's going to reach outside of our communities, that we end up doing more so with other oppressed peoples. And not just even in the United States or Canada. I'm saying we need to assert our right to do international trade. I've always felt it. South America, look, part of the reason there's such an influx of refugees coming to the United States is because the United States has been a major player in crippling economies around the globe. I mean, it stands to reason that if you live in a country where the only viable industries are drug trafficking, and you know that your country has resources and all those resources are going to the United States, well, maybe that's where I need to go too. It isn't just, the land of milk and honey. It's like, this is where your wealth is going to in the first place. So I think we need to do more. We need to do more from a Native to Native standpoint, and from a Native to any other oppressed group standpoint. And when I say Native to Native, I do mean indigenous peoples across the globe. I mean, there's almost nothing in the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples that really talks about us collaborating with each other. It talks about the minimum standards that nation states should recognize in terms of these rights that will secure the dignity and future of Native peoples. But it doesn't get specific enough. And part of it is if they tried to, boil it down anymore, it would have been harder to get nations to vote for it. So I understand, the politics of doing an international declaration like this. But it has no bite, has no enforcement powers, and these are the things that we have to strive for. And maybe these kinds of conferences that bring us together for economic development may also be the kind of conferences that we have these conversations about decolonization, conversations about, what kind of collaboration we actually can put together. I think that's important. And again, when I've seen how the artist community has reacted to the South by Southwest festival, I'm encouraged that some people are finally getting it and finally starting to realize that who they're associated with, who they do business with, who they buy from, who they sell to matters. And we can't just ignore that anymore. I don't think we can say, well, I'm just trying to earn a buck. I mean, I'm trying to support my family. At some point, we've got to be a little more conscious on who we do business with and again, how we vote with our dollars. And maybe we even eliminate some of that traditional types of currency transactions and we move in a way that has communities supporting each other in different ways other than just financial transactions. Who knows? We'll see where it goes from here. But those are the two issues I wanted to bring up. Again, I want to thank Gina Belafonte for introducing me to her mom. And I encourage people listening to this program to look her up. If you didn't know who Julie Belafonte is, well, that was your loss. But it's never too late to learn about what a tremendous human being she was. So, again, I wish the best of luck to all of the fine actors who were a part of Killers of the Flower Moon. And maybe the next time we tell the story a little bit better or we get to step up in telling the story. That's my show for this week. Look, I want to thank you guys for joining me. Whether you're listening to this show on WPFW or not, I ask that you support WPFW as the one of the stations carrying this program in particular this weekend. So let me give you their pledge number. Their number is 202-588-9739, or you can go online to WPFWFM.org, or you can go to /donate after that, or you can just follow the prompts and you can become a sustaining member by giving your credit card information or checking account information and just make a monthly payment of $5 or $10 a month, or you can make a one-time donation, whatever works best for you. But supporting radio stations like WBAI and WPFW is how words like mine get out there. So I want to thank those stations, and I want to thank you. I am John Kane, and this is Resistance Radio. We'll be right back.